It's easier if he turned his toes out. Yeah.
So he
Mine
spread his feet apart
are.
really, really wide, and then he still can't get to parallel, right? But he can get lower. Am I correct?
Good morning. Happy Monday. I have no coffee in hand, and it is perfect. All right. Coming off a very solid weekend. Saw some live music on Saturday. Had a big Zoom call with the intensive people on Sunday. Was a great call. Still a little high from that, so kind of excited. So let's dig into today's Q&A. This is with Victor. And so Victor presented two case studies in his consultation call. We went off of a chessboard, off the first one, which was a basketball player, end game narrow ISA, and then somebody with a wide ISA with the lumbar fusion. So we had a lot of things to consider. For those of you that are interested in understanding a little bit more about the end game representations, there are videos on the YouTube channel. So go and subscribe to that and get that information so you have that understanding if there's any confusion with this Q&A. If you would like to participate in a 15-minute consultation yourself, please go to askbillhartman@gmail.com, askbillhartman@gmail.com, and we can set up a 15-minute consultation from there. Just put 15-minute consultation in the subject line so I don't delete it. We will arrange that at our mutual convenience. Everybody have an outstanding Monday. Looking forward to a great week, and I'll see you tomorrow.
And there you go. We are now being recorded. Clock has started. Victor, what is your question?
All right, so I think it'd just be easier. I do have two chess boards, well, a chess board and a half. The full one is on this post-it note. I don't know if you can see it clearly or not.
High tech, okay, hang on. What am I looking at? What measures am I looking at?
These are hip range of motion.
Yeah, okay. Okay, got it.
And the trouble is, so he's a basketball player, trouble with getting into an athletic position with his feet facing forward. It's easier if he turned his toes out. Yeah.
So he spread his feet apart really, really wide, and then he still can't get to parallel, right? But he can get lower. Am I correct?
He can't even get to, like, I wouldn't even say parallel.
It's I know. Okay.
30 degree deflection. And
so
then
here's
moving
what you're looking at.
Is also a problem.
Yeah, here's what you're looking at. End game narrow, okay? End game narrow. So he's got AP compression, and he's pushed forward first, and then he went over to his right side a little bit, which is why you got the abduction measures that you got, okay? So here's what you got to do. You got to move him to the left, okay, and then move him backwards.
Okay.
Because if you try to move him straight backwards, he's just going to make he's going to orient everything together. Okay. Chances are, is he really tall?
Yeah, it's pretty tall.
Okay.
Somewhere around 6 feet.
Oh, that's not tall. That's not tall.
I'm pretty tall.
Well, it's taller than me. So, but it's not really tall. Like when we talk about like the 6'9", 6'10" guys.
Gotcha. Yeah, not that tall.
They have some other center of gravity issues, but so this guy probably won't do too badly, but chances are he's still going to orient to try to get depth just because of his physical structure and then his bias towards this type of a behavior, because this is a performance related behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
No. You go.
I was gonna say the other thing I was considering was the rate of connective tissue loading too. Like as he's moving, like it's one thing to have him breathe and in a static position, all these things. But as soon as he's moving quickly, it obviously increases stiffness, like you mentioned multiple times. So.
Yes. So yes, because he's got to be bouncy and he's got to be quick, right? And so that's how you use those connective tissues to your advantage. So a lot of times here's one of the mistakes I think that people make when they're dealing with athletes and performance is they're always comparing to the averages, right? So average range of motion. So there's not normal range of motion. There are average ranges of motion, right? And if I want an athlete to perform well, being average usually isn't the right answer, because average people don't get to play sports at high levels. Okay. It's
okay.
The above average people that have special qualities about them that get to do these things. So just because your guy can't do like a hip width deep squat or something like that doesn't mean there's something wrong with him. It just means that the performance related strategies that he uses reduces relative movement compared to the average, which is expected under many circumstances. There might be some times where we want to see a whole lot more range of motion out of him, like when he's in some sort of recovery phase or he's trying to recoup from a higher level performance, and we need to reduce some of the muscle activity, promote recoveries and things like that. But in general, you got a guy that's probably tuned up for performance related activities, right? So you can't rely on the averages.
Yeah. And the only way to know, I know you mentioned this before, like if you give somebody like that who uses compressive strategies for performance benefit, if you give somebody too much range of motion, there's only one, I would imagine the only way to find out if it's too much for that person is to give them a range of motion, retest whatever you're testing, and then
right.
go there.
Yeah, that's just part of the training process. So let me give you, for instance, so I got sent a message yesterday from one of my buddies that's working with a really high level pitcher that's coming off of a surgery. And we had a comparative video from before the surgery when he was throwing at a certain velocity, and another one where he was throwing at a different velocity, like it's actually a lower velocity coming off of his surgery. When you look at the relative movement that's available during the two videos, he's got less relative motion available to him when he's throwing faster, right? Okay. He looks better. He looks more comfortable in the new video, but he's not throwing as hard. And so then the question mark is like, okay, what do we need to give this guy? What do we need to take away? And so this is just part of the process. So, you know, with baseball, it's pretty simple at times where you can just use velocity as one of your KPIs. And then you say, well, how do we get this guy back up to his previous level of velocity? It's like, well, we might have to change something because he's a little different now, you know, because the constraints have changed to some degree, right? Because of a surgery, right? But this guy's, you know, the numbers that you threw up are not unusual when you see somebody that's dealing with a performance related strategy, right? But again, it's like my greatest concern with this is that we don't compare them to the average, because we don't want average. We want something else in most cases. Doesn't mean that in every case, you know, there might be somebody that's cool as a cucumber and can, you know, calm his system down anytime he wants. You know, I had a high level soccer player in the purple room here once, and he was so cool and chilled out, I thought he was gonna fall asleep. You know, because
I've interacted, I've had like one or two patients like that, like during treatment, I'm like, are you going to fall asleep on the table here?
Yeah, exactly.
No, nervous system arousal, I guess. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Okay. So move him left and then back. And I
right. Because you got to think about this from a structural standpoint. So when you see this end game representation, and you can see it in the numbers, right? You can see that he got pushed forward first. So he's on a very, very flat turn, and then he just kept going forward. Sure. He hit an anterior constraint where he couldn't go forward anymore. So he had to slide over top of his right leg. So that's the direction that he went. So it went boom, boom. Gotcha. So you got to reverse gears. You go boom. Okay.
Let's say if I took him straight back without taking him left, would that produce something like a right turn then?
No. So I'm sitting on a rolling stool, okay, that pivots. So if you try to take him straight back, right, all you're going to do is get this. Right?
So I get a left.
So you don't get relative motion. You just get an orientation out of it.
Gotcha. Okay.
You see it?
Yeah.
Because he's pushed forward. He's ready to pivot. Like he could pivot around his right leg. right? But it's like you got a stick in the ground, and then it's just a rotation around that stick. It's like what you want, if you're trying to recapture the relative motions, is I got to bring him back to, it's like, so he's off center. So he's over to the right, bring him back, and now you can bring him straight back. And then you're capturing the relative motions. You see it? So you're probably looking at, because of the amount of motion that he does have available to him, you're probably looking at some sort of like a short staggered stance, kind of an activity first kind of a thing.
Okay.
Depending on what he can recapture on his feet, you might have to take him to the ground and you know, like an armbar series or something like that. Depending on how far back you need to go, then it becomes a cross connect or something like that. It's like starting him at the high level. He's a performer. If he's not broken, you know, then I would treat him like an athlete first and see what you can recapture that way. And then just regress as much as you need to capture what you think you need to recapture.
Okay. And I guess I want clarification on bringing him left. In my head, I have... Is that in the imaginary frontal plane? Is this a turn to the left?
It's not a turn because his center of gravity went forward and to the right. So you got to bring the center of gravity back to the left.
Okay.
He's pushing right to left. It could be something as simple as a left crossover step with a sled drag.
Gotcha.
That might be enough to do it.
Okay.
You see what I'm getting at? It's like you just got to push him that way, and then he'll start to make his turn. And the turn is where the relative motion is. But you first have to get him into a place where he can actually capture relative motion. Because right now you've got an AP compression and you've got a pretty hard push to the right. It's like just reverse engineer.
Gotcha. Okay. I appreciate that one. Next. Uh-huh. This is not a chessboard. I'm going to give you like general qualities of this person. I think I've seen videos of you provide solutions in those scenarios. So 70-year-old male, wide ISA. Wait, 70?
70?
Yes. Okay. Different person, not the basketball player.
I didn't figure.
70-year-old male, wide ISA. So he has pain around both like sacral ala, like on the lateral aspect of both, worse on the left, lumbar fusion L3 to L5, absolutely zero hip interrotation, hip flexion stopped at like maybe 80 degrees, SLR was at like 45, not much abduction, hip ER on both sides actually wasn't too bad. Like if I remember correctly, like between 60 and 70, but just like overall stiff and just pretty crippling pain in the sacrum there. And I imagine that was just kind of his last compressive strategy in your lens.
Yeah. He's got another one up in the thorax most likely. So here's what you're dealing with. So, when you measure hip ER.
Okay.
Where do you think that's coming from?
The entire pelvis rolling?
Yeah. So they fused his lumbar spine. So you have no compensatory strategy there, right? Okay.
Yeah.
And so when you're measuring hip ER, like first of all, he's a wide ISA. So right away you're thinking I should have a deficit in hip ER. He doesn't have a deficit in hip ER, which means that you've got a lot of stuff that's moving together. Okay. So you've got a compressive strategy in the pelvis. The pelvis is moving as a single unit. So take the ilia, jam them together, lock the sacrum into place, and then lock the lumbar spine into place.
Just moving as a big
block. Where's the next space above the lumbar spine where you got movement?
Thorax, but
T1112.
Yeah.
Right? So he's probably rotating there. When you're measuring hip ER, right? So you're right. It's like all he's got is a sacrum that's just getting compressed between the two ilia at this point, right? So the pressure just builds, right? Mm-hmm. He gets pushed forward, right? So now you got to start thinking. It's like, okay, where can I make space? Can't use lumbar spine compensatory strategies, not moving the sacrum at all, right? So you're gonna have to create some form of AP expansion, right? So he's a side liar. He's gonna be a guy that you can use a lot of manual therapy on to get the rib cage to move, to get the pelvis to move.
Yeah, I've been having, so the treatment I've been doing with him so far, side lying, just taking the foam roller between the thighs and just trying to roll the femurs back and forth. He's at 90 degrees of hip flexion, which probably, as we were talking, is obviously compensatory if he's in a range of motion.
As you're shifting, if he's able to actually roll through the pelvis, you're rolling him on a helical angle. You're okay. It's just that you're starting him from midline. So you're starting him at middle P and then you're rolling him in and out. So he's actually doing this as he shifts. Okay. So you're probably okay there. The problem that you're going to run into though, is that you don't have enough pressure laterally to create the anterior expansion, right? So you're going to expand the available turn. It's just not going to be big enough. So you've got to go up into the thorax. You've got a thorax that's not moving either. Okay. You've heard me talk about dynamic ISAs, right?
Once or twice.
Okay. So you need a dynamic ISA to, because if he's not turning up here, you could spend all day on his side and you're not going to get anything, right? You're going to have to teach him to move his rib cage, right? Because he's got to reorient the helical angles to make a turn. And if he can't do that, he's not doing it through the pelvis and he's not going to do it through the thorax. And again, he's just locked into one piece. Does that make sense?
It does. Okay. So I had him like,
dude, I hate to say this.
All right.
You're no out worries. Of time. It's okay. It's all right. We're out of time. We can pick this up later. It's not pinching the glutes together as if you're trying to hide a quarter between your butt cheeks.
Good morning, happy Tuesday. I have NeuroCoffee in hand and it is perfect. That is really good. Okay, quick housekeeping. The intensive 14, we have set the dates for the intensive 14. That will be August 19th through the 22nd. We'll probably start application process somewhere late next week or so for that. Remember, we get to choose 8 people to come. So that's how many people fit in the purple room. And it also keeps it very tight and intense, if you will. So again, save those dates and be looking for that. Today's Q&A is with Leo. And Leo had some questions in regards to some hip range of motion measures that he was bumping into with some of his patients. And this led us into the 3 impingement concept. So the 3 impingements of the shoulder, 3 impingements of the hip, very, very similar. For those of you that would like to go beyond today's Q&A in regards to those impingement representations, I have 2 videos on the YouTube channel for those, 1 for 3 impingements of the hip and 1 for 3 impingements of the shoulder. So you'll see how those old school impingement tests that we were taught actually become positive, and then some rationale and some approaches as to how to alleviate those situations. So again, I think you're going to find this Q&A useful today. If you would like to participate in a 15-minute consultation, these are free of charge, by the way. I don't know if I've ever mentioned that. But it's just to help everybody out. So if you'd like to participate in a Q&A, please go to askbillhartman@gmail.com, askbillhartman@gmail.com, and we will arrange that at our mutual convenience. Just remember to put 15-minute consult in the subject line so I don't delete it. Everybody have an outstanding Tuesday. I will see you all tomorrow.
Okay, we are recording. Clock has started. What is your question, young man?
So I'm pretty new to I guess your methodology of things. So I've kind of picked up bits and pieces of it, just watching what you put on YouTube.
Gotcha.
So there were a couple of short clips that I saw. I think it was a seminar you were doing. I don't know if it was at IFAS, but it was with I believe he was a power lifter. So
Yeah, that was here.
Yeah. And I saw you put him in a couple positions and basically trying to improve, I think it was hip flexion and shoulder internal rotation.
Yeah.
So I guess my question and what I put in the email was basically about, you know, I work in a pretty busy private practice and trying to come up with different ways just to make the exercise intervention, you know, as effective as it can possibly be.
Yes, sir.
So kind of just some big pillars and things that I can have in the back of my mind in terms of positions that can help influence some of the big things that we see in clinic. So like common one in clinic for shoulder issues is usually a very restricted internal rotation. And then typically for the hip is hip flexion, where people come in and they get, you know, a lot of pinchy sort of sensations in the hip. And right. And those are like two very common deficits.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So hang on. real quick. There's two videos on YouTube that are going to be really, really helpful. Okay. And these are the three impingement. So there's three impingements for the hip and three impingements for the shoulder.
Okay.
Okay. And what I do is I go through the old school impingement tests. So the Hawkins-Kennedy painful arc, and then the end range impingement, because each one of those is representative of a compressive strategy in different areas. Okay. So when you're talking about somebody that comes in with limited internal rotation of the shoulder, like, you know, the positive Hawkins-Kennedy kind of thing. Okay. So under those circumstances, what you're lacking is you're lacking the early range shoulder external rotation measure, which would fall into the category of say early traditional shoulder flexion. Okay, but it's an ER measure. So when you have a posterior lower compressive strategy, so they have compression below the level of the scapula on the posterior aspect. Okay, what happens is that external rotation that would typically be in this area is now out there. It's away from midline. So the compression takes away that range. So what happens is they're moving into internal rotation where they should be able to externally rotate. So what happens is they literally run out of space as they move up, because this becomes more anterior expansion, posterior compression as I reach into this space, which compresses it even farther. So they literally run out of space. There is no more space for the shoulder to even move.
Okay.
Right? Yep. So what you need to do then is you need to restore the ability to expand below the level of the scapula. I got a whole bunch of stuff for that. If you look at some of the, like the Better Band Pull Apart is actually one of those exercises that's going to help with that. There's a seated version of that as well. But again, anything that's going to promote the expansive strategy below the level of the scapula is going to allow you to recapture that early flexion. So your hip people that are, they run out of hip flexion, it's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. Now, you got to start thinking about like where the pelvis is going to be oriented. So in both cases, where we have this posterior compressive strategy, you're going to get an anterior orientation of the thorax. You're going to get an anterior orientation of the pelvis. You have to reorient that first. So that's creating that posterior orientation, right? And then creating the expansion. So when we talk about expansion on the backside of the pelvis, especially we have a great representation of that in the sacrum with counternutation. So I need to be able to recapture counternutation. Well, but that requires that I reduce the anterior orientation first, because when the pelvis anterior orients or when the thorax anteriorly orients, everything's moving as a single unit. I no longer have relative motion between the scapula and the thorax or the ilium and the sacrum. So I got to get into a position where I can start to recapture that first. So first strategy under all of these circumstances is creating the reorientation where I'm no longer using the anterior orientation, which is an IR position, right? So IR, you probably heard me say this, is that internal rotation is a downward force, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So yep. That means that the pelvis has to dump forward and push down. It's like, I got to rotate it back so I can expand upward. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So would that be something like, depending on what the person can tolerate, would that be something as simple as having, so like in a quadruped position, if someone can kind of dissociate the pelvis into like a lumbar specific cat cow and then breathe into that, would that
be? You got to be really, really careful with, you got to be really, really careful with that type of an exercise, because there's a tremendous amount of substituting that can go on there. Right. So if you get somebody that is just bending the spine, so think about somebody that's using a rectus abdominis to pull a sternum and a pubis closer together, that would be the exact wrong thing to do.
Okay.
All right. So what you want, the way I always describe it to people is, imagine you got on your favorite pair of blue jeans and somebody's grabbing a hold of your back pockets and pulling down on them. That's the direction that we're talking about. So it's not pinching. It's not pinching the glutes together as if you're trying to hide a quarter between your butt cheeks, right? So it's never that kind of a squeeze. It's a posterior orientation. So what you got is and if we wanted to talk about musculature, you've got some adductor activity along with the posterior hip musculature that's gonna create this posterior orientation, okay? Right. So you could do this in any number of positions. You can do it you put somebody's hands on a chair and teach them how to do it in standing. You can lay them down. You can put them in a hook lying position. You've probably seen my cross connect video. You can do variations of that. All of that stuff is going to start to bring the pelvis into its posterior orientation. Okay. Got to do that first, because I got to create a position where the sacrum is free to turn. And if I am compressed and anteriorly oriented, there is no sacrum turning. The pelvis is turning as a single unit under those circumstances. No relative motions available in the pelvis.
Okay. So with the sacral position, when you're trying to determine what that is for an individual,
yes,
part of that coming from their ISA position.
Yes.
And then secondary to that, Do you use the position of the lumbar spine as well to give you an indication as to what that new patient is going to be? So if someone is like hyperlordotic or a little bit flatter through the lumbar, in addition to the ISA measure?
Okay. So let's just talk about one at a time. How about that? All right. So my IPA and my ISA are reflective of one another, right? So when I get a wide ISA individual, I got somebody that's biased towards the wide IPA, right? Yeah. And so this is the innominate bones being internally rotated on a nutated sacrum. This is no turn land, right?
Right.
This is actually where I'll find a lot of my high performance people, because they need to create such high forces and pressures into the ground. I don't want to dissipate the force. I want to magnify it. And so then they use this position a lot. So when you get a wide ISA individual in your office, this is your representation. So what's going to go with this is, if I've got a nutated sacrum, what I'm going to see is more internal rotation produced in the lumbar spine. So that would be traditional representation of extension. So anything that's extension is internal rotation, right? So I see a magnification of that. And so I can make some predictions off of that one simple measure of the ISA and say, okay, this individual is going to be biased towards certain strategies. And then I can start to work from there. Does that answer that question?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Because so sometimes there's things that you're going to be able to see that are visual, and they are supportive of your findings. And then there's sometimes where you just can't trust your eyes. Okay.
Yeah.
Under most circumstances with the nutated sacrum, you're going to see an IR lumbar spine.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Cause it's just in a couple of the videos, you kind of, when you're answering these people's questions, you kind of come back to, I kind of forget how you refer to it, but basically in a perfect world, in terms of what you would expect to see with a wide or a narrow ISA at the extremes. So I was just curious if you had any secondary measures that you use to try and confirm what you expect, you know, with regard to the sacrum, for example. Sure.
Well, okay. So let's just build this out a little bit as far as expectations go. All right. So under any normal circumstance, if I have a nutated representation of the sacrum, I have an ileal representation that's going to follow. So the ileum are going to be IR. That brings the innominate into IR. Okay. And that changes the orientation of the acetabulum. So the acetabulum is going to move up and forward. So that's an inverted representation of the acetabulum. So my expectation there is I'm going to pick up some internal rotation capabilities in the hip, and I'm going to lose some ER representation. Yeah. So right away, I have this foundational representation of what I should expect structurally as far as their bias is concerned. And remember, it's always a bias, because both ERs and IRs are always there. It's just how are they producing them, right?
Right.
So if I have, you know, if I have somebody that, and again, you'll never see this guy. So, but I'm using it as a representation. If I have a wide ISA individual that has full breathing excursion, I'm going to see, I might see a bias towards a little bit more intra rotation and a little less extra rotation, but he's still going to have some pretty decent movement capabilities where you're going to approach like the total motion representation is probably going to be about average.
Yeah. Right?
And so again, it's like, you gotta consider that guy. Like I said, we never get to see him because we don't see those people that have full movement capabilities. Cause when they do, they tend to feel pretty good. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But at least you can start to create the bias. And so then this is going to translate up into the axial skeleton and down into the feet, because it has to, because I've got these iterative aspects to anatomy. So the upper thorax and the pelvis tend to behave the same. The foot is going to be oriented in a certain way based on center of gravity. And so I have a center of gravity shift that's associated with the nutation, right? So that's going to drive my center of gravity forward. So I should expect to see the arch moving down towards the ground as they're translating the tibia forward over the foot. So again, it's right. Like you have these nice little representations. Now, there's a lot of other strategies that can be superimposed on that, but at least we have this foundational representation from which we can start to work. And we say, okay, this guy started in middle propulsion. So he's like literally right over his feet. And then I shifted his center of gravity forward. What should my expectations be under those circumstances? And then that's where you start to see the changes in the average ranges of motion start to disappear. When I start to get superficial stuff laid on top of this, we're going to start to lose more and more ranges of motion because we've taken away turns that we need to create these ranges of motion.
Right. Right. Okay.
Does that provide you an element of understanding? Because I know I'm talking fast because we only have a little bit of time.
Yeah. No, it gives me something to go off of for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, your narrows would be the opposing strategy. So they're going to be the ER bias. They're going to be the retroverted acetabulum, right? And then yeah. You're going to see early or late representations, depending on how far they are into these strategies. They're going to be biased towards ERs.
Yeah.
Yeah. But does that help you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good.
Yep. That'll
give me a little minutes. More. We got 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess my next question would be actually more with regard to assessment, and this can be quick, but like I know you've mentioned Diane Lee in previous videos about her thorax and pelvis.
Yeah, she's got great. The books are great for the mechanics.
Yeah,
yeah.
At a previous clinic I worked at, a number of the practitioners had done her integrated systems model training, and they kind of used that.
Uh-huh.
So her big thing is you know, trying to find the individual's driver that influences their task. So I was wondering for you, how caught up do you get in a person's, you know, injury history and things like that, with that kind of guiding your assessment or your treatment? Or do you just go off what you see and what you find and see how you can influence that?
Yeah. So the injury history can provide you a little bit of an understanding of a previous strategy. There right. might be a constraint change that's an influence. So as soon as you change the constraint, you have now just altered the movement options. So it's always a factor, but ultimately what you're gonna use for your primary frame of reference is what, like if you do table tests, you're gonna use your you're gonna use your chessboard that you're measuring off the table.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be what you're going to use to make your first decisions, your interventions, and then determine what your KPIs are going to be, right? But again, if I had somebody that came in and they said, "Well, I had a bank cart repair, and I never got my shoulder motion back," it's like, okay, I got to start thinking about that as a possible change in constraint that's now going to influence every decision that I make. So it's always on the table, so to speak, to make a pun. Yeah. It's always on the table. Right? It's always in the back of your head. You just have to decide how important it is.
Right.
All right, okay. Man. We are officially out of time.
Okay.
Great to meet you. If you got another question, let me know. We can always set up another one, okay?
Okay. Thanks so much.
All right, man. Have a great day.
You too. Bye for now.
Because the center of gravity is always going to go forward. You can't go backwards. We all know that there's no backwards.
Good morning. Happy Wednesday. I have NeuroCoffee in hand and It is. Perfect. Okay. Well, happy Wednesday. It's Wednesday, so that means that tomorrow's Thursday, which means 6 a.m. tomorrow morning, the Coffee and Coaches Conference call, as usual, as we have done for over the last year. So if you haven't joined us, please join us. Great group of people, great questions, solving problems, always fun. Speaking of the Coffee and Coaches Conference call, today's Q&A is with Cameron. So Cameron's a frequenter of the Coffee and Coaches Conference call. And we dug into some pelvic orientation stuff. So this is actually some really, really good foundational information in regards to the anti-orientation representation, how the superficial strategies will influence this. We talked a little bit about strategy in a specific case situation, which moved us into a little bit talking about this later representation of the propulsive foot. So again, really, really good foundational information. I think it's gonna help a lot of people. If you would like to participate in a 15-minute consultation, please go to askbillhartman@gmail.com, askbillhartman@gmail.com, put 15-minute consultation in the subject line so I don't delete it, and we'll arrange that at our mutual convenience. I hope you have an outstanding Wednesday. We'll see you tomorrow morning, 6 a.m., Coffee and Coaches Conference call. Have a great day.
Okay, we are being recorded. The clock has started. Cameron, fire away.
Okay. Sorry, I just have to put the volume up a little higher. I guess I had kind of a two-part question. I suppose the first part's kind of vague, and then I'll kind of give you a for an instance. So I guess I was kind of wondering what sort of the anterior sort of pelvic orientation strategy and kind of the relationship with that is with like the posterior lower, sort of as people get closer to an endgame strategy.
Uh-huh.
Is the anterior orientation just like an earlier sort of like earlier in the sequence of a compression strategy that someone will use, let's say in like a narrow ISA?
Yeah. So, okay. So when you think about how the superficial stuff is laid on, what we're doing is we're creating changes in the ability to produce the downward force. All right. So anything that you lay on that's superficially driven is going to be an exhalation strategy. So it's going to squeeze you harder. It's going to create more compression, right? And it's typically going to be associated with trying to produce more force downward. Okay. So it's an IR representation. I have my pelvis sitting right here.
Yeah. Nice.
Okay. So when I take this, so we sort of have this little cutoff line here, right through the ischium there at the top of the acetabulum. So that's where I sort of make my cutoff in discussion purposes. So I have musculature that's right here that's going to create this posterior compression and drive. When we're talking about the sacrum, it's going to push the sacrum that way, right? And we're going to see the same thing in the thorax getting pushed forward. And so if it's above the axis of rotation and I push this forward, it does that.
Got okay.
So it pushes down. This is down, right? So anytime I see something that goes that way, so my anti-orientation is me trying to boost that internal rotation downward. Okay.
Okay.
Does that help you?
Yeah. So that would be more of a like associated with the so it as the like the compression strategy would be above the level of the greater trochanter. I guess would often end up in kind of the space orientation of more of an anterior sort of pelvis orientation.
You don't really have a choice because when you think about the anterior musculature, so the anterior musculature is here, right? Okay. So if I start pushing here and this goes forward and then I push back here, look, it's kind of like this perfect storm,
right? To
create this downward force and then the orientation. I mean, like I said, you're just going to see the same thing happening in the thorax.
Okay. Yeah, that clears it up.
Okay. Let's talk about posterior lower, though. Can we do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Because you mentioned it. All right. Yeah. All right. So here's what's going to happen. So we got to go through space-time, right? So I start pushing here. I'm pushing this forward.
Yeah.
Right? This pushes back. And then I keep going forward, right? My center of gravity is going to go forward under these circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, I'm going to see this, where the pelvis is moving through space in that direction over the femur. So I'm going to fix the femur to the ground through the foot as a representation, right? So now I got this musculature down here. Mm-hmm. The farther forward that I go, this is going to be able to pick up concentric orientation.
Right.
Okay. So that, and then that creates compression in the posterior lower aspect. That's how you start to pick that up. So if we were looking at, say, a wide ISA representation,
mm-hmm.
right? Because typically under those circumstances, I'm going to have a nutated sacrum, which is going to give me eccentric orientation of that posterior lower aspect. But right. if I keep pushing things forward and forward and forward, again, I start to pick up concentric orientation here, and then I start to bend this sacrum up underneath. So that's one of my favorite representations to understand how you pick up this stuff, right? Because all it is I'm moving the two ends of a muscle, right?
Right.
closer and closer together. So it picks up concentric orientation. So that's a compressive strategy. So you slowly increase the amount of compression that you can apply in that area, because the center of gravity is always going to go forward. You can't go backwards. We all know that there's no backwards.
Right.
Just doesn't happen. And so you're always going to go in that anterior direction.
So I guess staying on that topic then, let's say if, like, for an instance type situation, or have someone maybe kind of presents where they're on that sort of right oblique angle, and then they've been pushed forward far enough at that point. So now they've got a loss of, early hip flexion, E or IR, much greater on, like, let's say the right side than the left side.
In regards to which?
The hip.
Which, when you say greater, you were mentioning ranges of motion. So
Sorry. Ranges of motion. So like both hip ER and IR.
Yeah. Like, so if they start, I understand now. Yeah. If you got somebody that started on a right oblique that loses hip IR, they're getting pushed way forward.
Okay.
Way.
So, and that's it. I guess I've been, maybe I'm getting too deep into it, but how much do I kind of need to pay attention to, like, the internal precision forces of?
Well, they're there. That's what's driving the show, right? And that's why all those strategies exist in the first place, mm-hmm. is to control the forces.
Yeah.
Right.
So if I'm trying to, like, increase, if I'm trying to give someone some, like, early, let's say, like, early hip flexion on that right side.
On the right side? Okay.
On the right side.
Okay. Let me help you. Yeah. All right. What direction did they move first?
They moved to the right first.
They moved on the oblique to the right.
On the oblique, the up and over for that relative.
And then what direction did they go to lose the early hip flexion, straight leg raise, and internal rotation? What did they lose? What direction did they go then?
Forward.
Okay. So if you were going to reverse engineer this whole process, which direction would you move them first?
Backward.
Yeah. So straight back and then back on the oblique. There you go.
Okay.
This is because everybody's going to end up in the same place.
Yeah.
Generally speaking. Generally. Okay. Right. Because we're all dealing with the same forces.
Right.
So we're all going to try to end up in the same place. It's just like, how did you get there? So we have different starting conditions. So if we look at my wide ISA archetype, and we look at my narrow ISA archetype, those are just different starting conditions. Forces being the same, they're just going to behave a little bit differently, but ultimately, because it's the same force, they're going to manage it very similarly as they start to lose capabilities, right? Yeah. So they all start with different strategies, but they're going to end with the same one, because everything gets narrower and narrower and narrower as far as, like, what's available to you. So if I start with this big of a space to move in, right? And then I start to battle whatever it is, internally and externally from a force standpoint,
mm-hmm.
I can slowly squeeze everything in. Now my movement capabilities are here, right? And that's going to happen to both archetypes. Gotcha. But because the starting conditions are different, things drop off at a little bit different sequence. But ultimately, at end game, they're going to measure very similarly.
And that, so then say if we went down to the foot, because that was kind of where I was sort of trying to piece together that what we were just talking about to what the foot representation would be.
Uh-huh.
So in that case, would it look like that? So we get closer to that sort of end game situation where someone's pushed far enough forward that their foot presentation would probably look a little bit more like either the high arch type person or the foot turned out. Because and that's why you would say you've got to get them to early propulsion first.
Right, because so it's an Eard representation. So remember, a late propulsive foot is the re-external rotation, right?
Tibia and stuff, yeah.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Right, but because the center of gravity is not far enough forward, the heel is still on the ground, so it pulls the arch back up, and then I bring the toes back underneath. So the muscles that would typically lift the heel in a normal late propulsive representation can't lift the heel because center of gravity's not far enough forward yet. And so it reverses gears, and then it's dead guy anatomy 101. What do these muscles do based on their name? It's like, well, they're toe bender muscles. And so I got short toe extensors on top. I got long toe flexors on the bottom, and I get this quad representation of the toes. That's why you see that, is because that's somebody that's trying to get up and over the front of their foot, and they can't do it because their center of gravity is too far back. So it just grabs and pulls.
So that would be the airplane wing sort of situation you're talking about, where like got the high pressure underneath. That's the concentric overcoming in that situation. Okay.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Perfect. This is clearing a bunch of little stuff up for me.
Good.
You got 5 minutes. Yeah. 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
Oh, perfect. So then, I guess kind of there's one exercise that you had put up quite a while ago. And then I saw, I was following Mike Campanini, and he had executed this exercise where the one, it was more for like a wide SA individual, and you're trying to regain hip internal rotation with the bands around the knees. And you went towards the deep squat.
Deep squat.
So I guess for my interpretation, it was like, you're going out to try to force IR to try to create that concentric. Yeah.
Okay. So you're not pushing out.
So you're still not. So even in that wide sitting, it's still not a push out. It's still
you're not pushing out.
Okay.
You're trying to reduce so the muscles above the trochanter, as the pelvis becomes anteriorly oriented, they become internal rotator muscles, right? They change their direction of pull. Right. So for me to sit down into a deep squat, I'm trying to capture an Eard representation, early propulsive representation of that pelvis. So if that musculature is concentrically oriented, the chances of me capturing an early representation of the pelvis in the bottom of a deep squat are slim to none. So what I'm doing is I'm fixing the femur with the force of external rotation against the band, but I don't want to push it apart. Because if I push it apart, all I'm doing is creating the posterior lower compression, and I'm orienting the femurs into ER. I want to capture relative motions in the pelvis. So what I have is I have a stimulus, that band stimulus creates the ER moment that makes the musculature above the trochanter eccentrically orient as I descend into the deep squat. Then I superimpose the inhalation on top of that, and I get this nice little early representation at the bottom of the deep squat. That's what that's for. Because you watch the sequencing, so you start in a late propulsive representation at the top of the squat. You've got the foot elevated on a platform, okay, with toes in line with the forefoot. Okay, so it's not the late representation. Just elevating the heels doesn't do it. You need the platform to do this. Okay,
yeah.
Right. And so as I descend, you descend it with an exhale till you get through the sticking point where you would be biased more towards that internal rotation. Well, that's where the pelvis is going to start to pick up that IR representation. So the musculature above the trochanter is going to be more IR biased, right? You have the band on there that's going to reduce the ability of those muscles to maintain their IR bias. And then I sit down below that level where I would typically recapture early representation. And I breathe in, sacrum can counter nutate. I have ilia that can ER under those circumstances, and I capture that early representation of propulsion at the bottom of the squat.
And would kind of the like an analogy to that exercise for the upper extremity be that like dorsal rostral band pulled apart?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
How much time do I have?
1 minute and 31 seconds.
So let's say someone, all right, I think I can do this quick. So let's say it's been a session, they've regained some semblance, even if it's, you know, of internal rotation at that point. Let's say for like, you know, our younger, you know, population, or it doesn't have to be younger, but just anyone that's more of our, that wants to be active in that case. So if I want to kind of use that range, would that be now, let's say if I want to start to use like a change in tempo, would that be more of like, so now I want to be able to drop quick and have that heavy exhale to grab that concentric orientation and use what they just got?
Yeah, you can do that. And you're also influencing connective tissue behavior into the overcoming action as well. So you're getting a lot of stiffness,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, yes, you can. So we'll start to do that too. You can actually, I do that with my patients all the time. They don't recognize it, of course. But yeah, you can definitely do that.
Okay.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong. Right. Like the forces matter. The forces matter. Like going quickly or going slowly does matter. If I'm trying to create an expansive strategy, I will tend to slow the tempo down. If I'm trying to create more of a compressive strategy, overcoming action, that's a higher rate of load for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I guess that's the part where the patient population, right? I don't have the clientele that I'm usually just working on expansion all the time for pain relief in that case. That
this is where your safe to fail experiments come into play, young man. This is how you learn.
Right.
I gotta create something. As long as you understand the representations, experiment, and then look at the outcomes and let that lead you. Okay.
Okay.
All right, man. Thanks, gotta go. Good to see you.
Yeah, talk to you later.
Once I have that capability, once I demonstrate the ability to kind of demonstrate control with the touch and go, then I might want to say, okay, I want to move you from this eccentric orientation to concentric orientation at a higher rate.
So I've been working on manipulating variables with the box squat, and So I've been working a lot specifically on getting clients to develop more overcoming qualities. And so, you know, focusing maybe a little bit more on getting them towards the sticking point and looking for indications that they're keeping a concentric pelvic diaphragm. And so I've tried a couple of different breathing strategies besides just like a traditional breath hold, because my understanding is that that can be interference when you've got somebody who's who's having trouble with that sticking point. And I just want to run them by you and see if there's any thought logic in the thought process. Is that okay? Okay. Yeah. So one is just getting them, provided that they can start in like a neutral or not neutral. Nope. Bad. provided that they can get the standing representation right, having them just exhale as they go down on a relatively quick relatively quick descent, and then come up, and then the other is like a slow eccentric, so they have to breathe the entire time, because I was thinking both of those would help with eliminating the breath hold and maybe helping to create the concentric pelvic diaphragm. And so am I thinking about that in any coherent way, or is that?
Yes, but.
Okay.
Okay, so let's think this through for a sec. So one of the problems that you run into when you're actually breathing under load is that you're gonna get, technically speaking, more relative motion, okay? And so you gotta be really, really careful as to the timing of things, and one of the things that you need to recognize is that if somebody's doing a breath hold, okay, that is an exhalation strategy. Okay, so the reason the air is not coming out is because you're cutting it off, right, at the glottis, and so then you're going to create that internal pressure, and it'll be an exhalation strategy. So you don't have to physically exhale per se. And when you're trying to create and I'm assuming you're trying to make a concentric overcoming situation.
Yes.
Okay. under those circumstances, because it sort of complicates that, especially when you're playing with something where the force production is a little bit higher. Like when we're talking about like the, you know, the heels elevated goblet squat that we would use to try to recapture relative motion there, we want to make sure that we're breathing through the excursion. In your situation, I wasn't there, so I can't speak with great intelligence here, but the thing that I would say is that if you're trying to get concentric overcoming, the breath hold's going to be okay, because that's literally going to create the higher internal pressure, and it'll help maintain the concentric orientation of the outlet. And then it's just a matter of superimposing the rate or load as you are on top of that. So again, depending on what the goal is. And in this case, it's you're trying to limit the relative movement, would be my understanding. Am I correct?
Yeah. Well, cause I noticed that with people who seem to have trouble with the internal rotation and overcoming that, through that, the middle of the squat, that's when they deviate the knees outward. That's when they get, you know, traditional extension of the lumbar spine and all of that. And so my thought process was, at least for the lighter sets, I guess I should clarify that an exhale could at least like limit the volume, right? It is being presented internally, and then lead to maybe using a breath hold strategy, when there's some weight involved, right? Because then it's
I think that clarifies it to a much greater degree, for sure. Okay. Like if you're going to add speed, or you're going to add load, again, just from an execution standpoint, it's much easier to take the breath and then compress that versus the active exhalation. But if you're not under load and you're just trying to cue the fact that I need an exhalation strategy, and they don't really have a good one, like they're not used to producing pressure, then I'm totally cool with that.
Okay. And then one more question. So I was thinking this through, and in terms of, again, the same type of person, we're trying to create the concentric pelvic diaphragm or maintain it. And there's two sort of general strategies, as far as I can tell. One is to you know, get somebody to kind of sit to the box and then be able to create that pressure off of the box, right? So dissipate the forces and then create that pressure off the box. Yep. And then one that I haven't seen you really use that seems plausible is having them just use the box purely as a constraint, so that they're making sure that they're not just sitting back to the box, and that they're actually creating pressure as they go down, the knees are going forwards. So I'm wondering, like, are there
like touch and go?
Like a touch and go where you're really, you're just like using it as a constraint to make sure that your knees are going forward a little bit, and you're not just sitting back. What would you think about the relative application of those two methods?
Okay. So here's how I would look at that. Are you trying to capture a capability, or are you trying to train their ability to use that ability, that capability, faster? So if you had somebody that was struggling to capture the concentric orientation, the slower descent and touch and go strategy is probably the better way to go, because it does maintain it from the beginning of the squat, right? So there's a limited amount of eccentric orientation, right? Because I'm maintaining some measure of internal pressure throughout, and I'm not releasing any tension onto the box that would create the yield or any measure of eccentric orientation. Okay. Once I have that capability, once I demonstrate the ability to kind of demonstrate control with the touch and go, then I might want to say, okay, I want to move you from this eccentric orientation to concentric orientation at a higher rate. And in that case, now you're going to deload to the box, and you're going to try to pop off the box. Do you see the difference in the two? Where one is like sustained, and the other one is like release and then recapture.
Okay, so it's a question of whether you already have that position or whether you're trying to strengthen that position.
Yeah, it's like on one end, it's like the my first goal is I got to be able to capture the concentric orientation of the outlet. On the second one, it's like, how fast can I capture the concentric orientation of the outlet, right?
Okay, cool. That helps a lot. Good.
Yeah, and so Andrew, this is actually a big deal. So I see a fair number of females that would have an issue with outlet control, and this is like how you have to do it. You have to teach them this sustained element first, because they don't even have this high pressure strategy at all. And so for me to say sit down in the box and pop off, it's like it's very hit and miss as far as your success rate goes. But when you teach them to touch and go first, and then they understand, it's like, oh, this is where the high pressure is. This is how I manage this. Then it's much easier to superimpose the great stuff on top of it.
Right, right. Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, so I have somebody that as she descends, she can descend quickly, but she's still not capable of turning the eccentric to concentric fast enough.
Good morning, happy Friday. I have NeuroCoffee in hand and it is perfect. All right, well, I'm kind of fired up. Noon Eastern today, IFAS University members only. Mike Robertson and I will be on the same call. This is a bonus call for you guys that we've been thinking about for a while. And so please join us. If you haven't signed up for IFAS University, go to ifasuniversity.com so you can join us at 12 noon today. Okay, diving into today's Q&A. This is two segments from yesterday's Coffee and Coaches conference call. We had a similar situation show up in two different contexts. And it was regarding the pelvic outlet behavior. One of the things that we have to think about when we're talking about vertical jumps or when we talk about transitions in the Olympic lifts where we have sort of the unweighting element or the counter movement in a vertical jump, the outlet behavior becomes very, very important. So the ability to transition from an eccentric to a concentric pelvic outlet, the ability to store and release energy via yielding and overcoming actions is also very important. And so we'll see deficits in those behaviors. And so we went through two different strategies that we talked about for these two different contexts. So one was using a box squat and one was using an oscillatory variation of a squat to try to resolve these things. So again, very useful Q&A for a lot of people, a lot of coaches. If you would like to participate in a Q&A, 15-minute consultation, please go to askbillharmon@gmail.com, askbillharmon@gmail.com. You can get signed up there. Put 15-minute consultation in the subject line so I do not delete it. We will arrange that at our mutual convenience. I got a bunch of those to schedule that in a backlog, so please be patient with those. Everybody have an outstanding Friday and a great weekend, and I'll see you on Monday.
My question is about vertical jump. So I'm working with a young lady. What she seems to do on the descent is she'll descend down into her sticking point and then she'll almost like re-descend at the bottom before she goes up. Uh-huh. So kind of going off of what Andrew's question was, my initial thought was, hey, we could probably use a touch and go. But what when she jumps, she's kind of like what you said in your wide ISA video where she's a back jumper. She's a narrow ISA. So I'm still kind of confused on that. So I'm trying to figure out which intervention to throw in first in terms of like a box squat to kind of help with this. Do I need to capture the concentric overcoming first because she almost like is waiting for the guts to get down there?
Okay. She's not waiting. Okay. But so think about this. So she descends a little bit faster than her guts, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the guts hit the bottom and then she kind of double clutches. So she descends and then she descends again. Because when the guts hit, they're pushing her down even farther. So the box squat then becomes incredibly valuable here. And literally the discussion that we had with Andrew becomes your strategy. It's like, oh, okay. So I have somebody that as she descends, she can descend quickly, but she's still not capable of turning the eccentric to concentric fast enough. And so the guts hit, she has to yield again, right? You see it?
Mm-hmm.
And so what you want to do then is you say, well, where do we optimize this position? That tells you where to set your box. And then you say, can you execute a controlled touch and go, right? Start to load that so you get concentric orientation. And then you transition this to a deload onto the box and the pop up. So now she knows to stop and then come up quickly. And then you slowly take the box away. So the way you take the box away is you take a pad, you take a mushy pad, you put it in the box. So she still has a sensation of depth, right? But now she has to do the controlling of the turnaround. And then you eventually take that away and she does the vertical jump. You see, you just progressively take away the constraint.
One quick follow-up to that would be if someone, like, relatively speaking, she's very strong. I mean, like, double body weight deadlift, like probably body weight and a half squat. She's a soccer player.
Yeah.
So how does that not, wouldn't she be probably more concentrically oriented in the pelvic diaphragm? So I just don't know why she would do that. I mean, obviously she's not based on her jump, but.
So, okay. But you have connective tissue behaviors that are also in play here. So given enough time, so a deadlift is really slow compared to the counter movement in a counter movement jump, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you may have a situation where she can't go from the yield, which is the energy storing position, to the energy releasing position.
Got it. Makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. So I don't think the strategy would change all that much because you are still emphasizing the connective tissue behavior as described, right? So the depth, and that might have something to do with it too. So think about where the hips are positioned in her deadlift relative to where she's going to be for the counter movement jump, because they're not the same, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Does that help?
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely.
And then I had a similar situation to what Thomas asked. You know, sometimes when I have people do the dip for a jerk, so they dip and then they go up, or push press or whatever, you know, sometimes people will, they dip too deep. And so then they dampen the dip and then they have nothing to go up with, and it sucks. So sometimes people will prescribe to do a pause. So you just dip until you reach the depth that you need to go to, so you get the body awareness of how far you actually need to go. Yeah. Problem with that is that sometimes you'll have people, okay, they pause, but then in order for them to go up, they go deeper to try to get momentum to try to go back up.
Right. They're trying to create the yield so they can store and release the energy. You're absolutely right.
Whereas what you want to do is dip and then from there just go. You know?
Yeah.
So yeah. It's like you try to do the pause so that they get that depth, but then it doesn't really help them because then when they actually try to move, they just keep going down.
Right. You're absolutely right. That would be typical because again, they understand the dynamic nature of it, but they don't have the strategy available to them. One of the simplest things to do is one of the oscillatory activities. So you put them just above where you would want them to take the dip. Have them ramp up all of the tension. So you create the exhalation strategy and then you have them release it. Boom. And so you create this little oscillation. And so that's what I would do versus just trying to stop and say hold and this is your spot. I would play with that, like literally creating an oscillation in that position. I've got a deeper representation of that. It's either like an oscillatory squat or a reactive squat on my YouTube page. But all you got to do is pick the right depth and you can just like literally just teaching them to create tension, release, and then retention again. That's in my mind, it's just a better way to teach that versus just the static hold.
Yeah. See, those, yeah, I use those sometimes. Those are like jerk discs. I usually use those with people who have, who are too concentric, because they go down too slow, you know, like they're like super stiff, and then they'll muscle it up, but they suck at dipping quickly. So the oscillation is what kind of pushes them down, you know,
push them down,
kind of bouncing with them. And so then it kind of forces them to
right, the yield.
Yield.
Mm. The yield. Yes. Yes.
So, and then the people who tend to dampen tend to be the narrow, you know, tend to be women and narrow ISAs.
Yeah.
So, but you're saying that that kind of jerk dip activity would still work for the narrows?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. Because again, you're trying to teach the representation of high tension, release the tension, recapture the tension in both circumstances.
But just do it at a higher.
I would start them just above where you would think that the ideal dip representation would be, because I don't want them to descend below that, because that's what they're already doing.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But like, literally, it's like you can put a barbell on their shoulders and teach them how to do that under resistance, and then superimpose that representation onto the dip for the jerk or push press.
Okay. Cool.